It says in verse 1, in the seventh month, in the 1 20th day of the month, came the word of the Lord by the prophet Haggai, saying, Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and to the residue of the people, saying, Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, O Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts. According to the word that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, so my spirit remaineth among you, fear ye not. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, Yet once, or yet first, it is little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth, and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations. And the desire of all the nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts. The glory of this latter house shall be greater than that than of the former, saith the Lord of hosts. And in this place will I give peace, saith the Lord of hosts. Now, we know from not only from the writings of the prophets, but also from secular history and Josephus' writings and so on, that the glory of the Lord did not fill that house, not like it did Solomon's temple. In Solomon's temple, the glory came down in the eighth day of tabernacles, since the Feast of Tabernacles was an eight-day feast time. But on the eighth day of tabernacles, the glory came down and filled the whole house, and the priest couldn't even go in there because the glory was so full of it. The smoke filled the temple. But this did not happen with this temple that Zerubbabel was building. Didn't happen. So, did Haggai's prophecies fail? That's the question. Well, I'm sure that many thought it would. Many thought that it did, because their expectations seem to be shattered here at this point. Verse 1 of this chapter 2 says that this particular word came in the seventh month in the 21st day of the month. That is the seventh day of the Feast of Tabernacles. I believe that this came the night before, or the day before, the eighth of tabernacles, when they were dedicating this temple, and they expected the glory to fill this temple. And then it didn't. Why? There's the question. Why? Well, obviously, first of all, it's because, since we have good 20/20 vision, 20 hindsight here, we can see that Haggai's prophecies were not really applicable to that particular house. The glory of this latter house would be greater than the former. But the people actually wept. Those who had seen and who remembered Solomon's temple, when they were a child, they remembered going there. And here they were probably in their 80s, 90s by this time. They remembered the former glory of Solomon's temple, and they wept because this wasn't anything like it. It was just nothing like it. How in the world can this house be greater in its glory than Solomon's temple? Well, obviously it wasn't. But the temple that Haggai was really talking about is you. We are the temples of the Holy Spirit. We are being built up with the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with the chief cornerstone being Jesus Christ. He is building us into a temple with living stones, and that is the temple that His glory is going to fill. And this is not merely a Pentecostal prophecy, this is a tabernacles prophecy. In that sense, the glory of this latter house shall be greater than that of the former. And in this place, I'll give peace. For Solomon means peace, right? And he was the prince of peace, David's son, King David's son. So he was a prince, and his name means peace. He is the pattern of the prince of peace coming. And The place, or the Ark of the Covenant, was the place where the presence of God came to rest. Remember when they brought this Ark of the Covenant, when they built it in the wilderness under Moses, it wandered around the wilderness and they kept the staves in there because it was not at rest. It says that it sought a rest for the people of God. It was not until 400 and some years after they crossed the Jordan under Joshua that David came on the scene. He had his personal tabernacle, a tent, with the Ark of the Covenant in it, called the Tabernacle of David. But he was not allowed to build the temple. God says, no, because you're a man of war. You got to give it to a man of peace to do. So his son Solomon was called to build this temple. So when David died, Solomon took the throne. Solomon built the temple. The Ark was put into it on the eighth day of Tabernacles. The glory of God filled it. And in that sense, we find that the Ark came to rest. It's the place of rest. Now that is a pattern of us as well. This is not a time where we get a Pentecostal infilling of the Spirit. This is a pattern of the Feast of Tabernacles, the eighth day of Tabernacles, which Jesus prophesied about in John chapter 7. When he kept the Feast of Tabernacles in the New Testament. And he talked about this, verses, what, 37, 38, 39, where he says that if any man thirst, let him come unto me for drink. Out of his belly will flow rivers of living water. And this spake he of the Spirit, which had not yet been given. Pentecost was a type and a shadow of it. It was a down payment, but it was not the Feast of Tabernacles. Jesus spoke those words on the eighth day of Tabernacles, the last great day of the feast. Pentecost is a down payment of the Feast of Tabernacles. Let's go back into Haggai chapter 2 and see what is going on here. This is occurring on the seventh day of Tabernacles. The year is not given. The year is not given here. But it is apparent that there is about a five-year gap between chapter 1 and chapter 2. The gap here is alluded to, I think, because verse 3 seems to indicate that the temple had been built by this time. Otherwise, his statement is kind of meaningless. Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory, and how do you see it now? Well, obviously, they had built this temple so that they had something to see. And the people in Ezra 6:15 or Ezra 5, and in these passages here, they were weeping because the temple was just not like it was at all. I think that this indicates that this prophecy is coming in October of 515. In other words, it's about 6 or 7 months after the actual completion of the temple. They did dedicate it back in April of 515, shortly after they completed it, because we do have records of that in Ezra, where they dedicated it according to the word of Moses. Now, of course, you can check with, I think it's the seventh chapter of Numbers, that deals with that, where each of the 12 tribes offered up an offering to God on his day. The first day of the first month, the second day of the first month, the third day of the third of first month. The first day of the first month is when they had built or erected the tabernacle of Moses. The next day was the tribe of Judah, I believe it was. Each of the 12 tribes, whatever order that they were, each of the 12 tribes offered their offerings to dedicate the altar. And so they would have completed on the 13th of the first month. The last tribe. And then the next day, the 14th, was the preparation day where they were to kill the lamb for Passover in the afternoon. And that evening and the next day was actually the day of Passover. So the indications are that they did this again in this latter, this second temple, and actually dedicated it prior to the day of Passover, and then they kept the Passover. That's what we find indicated pretty much in the book of Ezra. As for the glorification of this temple, Haggai gets this word in the fall. That is, in the seventh month, 21st day of the month. Now, the Feast of Tabernacles went from 715 to 721, seventh month, 15th day, to the seventh month, 21st day. And then this is the 7 days of Tabernacles. And then the 8th day of Tabernacles is always the 22nd of the month. That is the day, as we said, was the day that Solomon's temple was glorified, and also the day that Jesus prophesied in John 7 would be the outpouring of the Spirit again in a tabernacles fashion, 722. So on 721, Haggai is prophesying, and he's saying, he's implying that the house was built, but it was nothing like the other one. And he is saying, the glory, he says, I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. He's prophesying that. And of course, the natural assumption would be that this would occur on the next day, according to Solomon's pattern. Well, it didn't happen. So the question is, why? You know, the same thing essentially occurred in 1996, in the fall of 96, when we were expecting to see the same kind of manifestation occur. And people wondered, why didn't it happen? It did happen, in the same way that it happened back here. That's the thing that we're going to look at here. We're going to make some comparisons and see what happened. Now, you know that on the seventh day of Tabernacles, we too got a revelation from someone sitting right over here on the left. And the revelation came from the book of Zechariah, actually, which parallels this Haggai revelation. Zechariah 4:6. Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts. Under Moses, the Lord came with great might, a big show. In the book of Acts, he came with power. But under Tabernacles, he comes just by my spirit. It's like the oil of the Spirit, as Zechariah 4 talks about, where the two olive branches or olive trees are pouring the oil into the candlestick. It's a hidden work. It's a silent work. It's something that is hidden, and it is not greatly visible, like in Moses' day, where you could see it for miles. It wasn't even visible in a partial manner, like it was in Jerusalem at the day of Pentecost. But now it's very hidden of what he is doing. Now let's see some characteristics back in Haggai chapter 2 to see what actually did occur here, and we'll draw the parallels between Haggai's day and our own day as well. First of all, verse 3. The end of verse 3 says, is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? As nothing, okay? Together, the Yod and the Zion put together forms the letter Ayin, which is translated here in Haggai as nothing. Okay? It's something that only sees but does not speak. It empties itself so that it can be filled with God. That's what this temple was. It was as nothing. When we, as the temples of God, become as nothing, then we too are filled with the presence of God. Basically what it's saying. You have to become absolute zero. The place of no resistance. The place of superconductivity. 273 degrees Celsius, minus 273. The number that we find in the book of Numbers, dealing with the sons of God, those who are redeemed. You see the, like I said, I'll just draw this here. The Yod plus the Zion Z-Y-A-I-N equals I-N, translated nothing. If you look at Strong's Concordance, word number 369, which is I-N, he defines it as to be nothing or not exist. And it's related also to the next word, number 370, in the sense of query. It's the question where. Like, where is it? You know, it ain't there. There's nothing there. Now, isn't that exactly what happened in Haggai's day? This temple was as nothing. Where is it? Okay, you got all this promise about the glory of God coming. Now, where's the beef? What happened? Nothing happened. Isn't this as nothing? Yeah, it's exactly like it. There is nothing that happened. But does that mean that God was not in it? No. Be strong, Zerubbabel. Be strong, Joshua. And be strong, you remnant of the people, because I am in this work. I am with you. What is that? I am with you. That's the promise of Emmanuel, God with us. That's the glory of his presence that fills us. I am with you. Or you could say it a little different way. I am with you. I don't care about this building out here. That was just a matter of obedience. I'm really building something in you. So while you're out here building a physical structure, I'm only putting you through your training exercises because now you're learning to hear my voice and act in faith. And what I'm really looking for is what I'm building in you. You are the real temple. Now there's the revelation. When they have no more resistance to God, then they can become superconductors of the glory of God into the whole world. It's really what he's talking about. And it's all bound up in this crazy little old word, nothing. I find that rather interesting myself. I don't care if anybody else does or not. I think it's interesting. So in Hebrews 12, he tells us, beginning in verse 18, that we are not come to a physical mount that can be touched, but unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. God does not care about dwelling in houses made of literal stone, bricks, or wood, or what have you. That's not what he's at. He did that at one time, but that was a parable so that he would understand. We would understand what he is doing in us, because we are the temples of God. These externals are only types and shadows of what he's doing in us. So, be strong, because I am doing the unexpected, and this whole thing seems to be as nothing, and where is it? But God has worked a work in us, and I believe that that work was established because we did everything that the Lord said to do. So Isaac finally comes after all this time of where is it, you know, a time of barrenness, if you will. Sarah was barren for how many, many years, and then finally when it was impossible, then God did it. Well, it's the same thing. But the fact is that God is working a work that's hidden. It's hidden. And if you look real quickly over at Zechariah 4 again, he says in verse 10, for who hath despised the day of small things? The yod is the smallest letter of the alphabet. Who hath despised the day of small things? He's saying that this is a small thing. This is a day of small things. Small beginnings. But such a small beginning has tremendous implications throughout the world. God is not anymore doing the ostentatious. That was okay for Mount Sinai. And then he cut back and toned it down for the day of Pentecost. And now it's a completely hidden work when it's the beginning. It's like this pattern of Haggai's temple, or the temple that Haggai was prophesying about. Something really small. The Lord began to speak to us about 1996, back as early as 1991. And the more that he spoke to us about this, and showed us the timing involved over a period of some years, we walked this out. We did a 5-year building project already, actually, those 5 years. And I believe that this whole thing will be repeated again in some form or other from the year 2001 to 2006. The point is, in our obedience, we were learning to hear His voice. We were learning to be obedient to the Word, even as the people in Haggai's day were learning to be obedient to the Word back then. The results of it were not what we expected, but what was God really doing? God was doing a work within us that even we did not understand what He was doing. And that's okay. We don't have to understand it all. We knew on October 5th, 1996, the eighth day of Tabernacles that year, actually we knew the evening before, when the Lord said, "It will not be by might nor by power, but by my Spirit," that's when we knew that we were not going to see what we had expected the next day, any more than they did back here. But that's okay. We were still required to make the declaration, and we did. We were obedient to the vision that we had. Let's get back to Haggai chapter 2. Verse 5. It says, "I am with you according to the word that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt. So my Spirit remaineth among you. Fear ye not." See, even though the Spirit of God was not poured out and glorified, that temple was not glorified in Haggai's day. Even so, he says, "My Spirit remaineth among you. Fear not." Be strong. Fear not. When Israel came out of Egypt, the first stop that they made was Sukkoth. Sukkoth, as you know, means tabernacles. So the Feast of Tabernacles is very interesting because it was the first stop that Israel made when they came out of Egypt. They traveled one day and they came on that first day, at the end of the day of Passover, to Sukkoth. S-U-K-K-O-T-H is usually how it's spelled. So, they came to dwell at Tabernacles the moment they came out of Egypt. It's very interesting. Exodus 13:20, I think, is the reference on that. But then he goes on and he says, verse 6 of Haggai 2, verse 6, "For thus saith the Lord of hosts, yet once, it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all the nations." I wonder if perhaps this isn't a hint that deals with this timing. In other words, you have Sukkoth, 8th of Tabernacles, 1996, which is October 5, and then you have the shaking of all nations. See, in Israel's experience, after Sukkoth came the Red Sea. Pharaoh's armies got shook up a little bit. He shook not only the dry land, but also the sea. Kind of an interesting thing. This is what comes next. And I wonder if perhaps this order isn't a little bit prophetic of what's going on. And of course, perhaps the shaking of all the nations is necessary to prepare the way for the declared word to actually become a manifested reality. 1996 is the declared word. And I have no doubt in my mind that that word shall not return void. It will. It will go forth and it will accomplish that for which it was intended. We saw too many signs and wonders to believe anything else done other than that. First of all comes the shaking, okay? Now let's see a New Testament commentary on that to get some idea what it means. In the book of Hebrews, we find in chapter 12, verse 25, "See that you refuse not him that speaketh. For if they escape not, who refused him that spake on earth, much more shall not we escape if we turn from him that speaketh from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth. But now he hath promised, saying, yet once more, I shake not the earth only, but also heaven. And this word yet once more signifieth the removing of those things that are shaken, as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. Wherefore, we, receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace, whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. Now, he's still talking in the context of Moses. Really, the book of Hebrews is a commentary about the days of Moses and how it applies in our own day. And he says that the voice of God shook the earth in Moses' day. It's also, yet once more, I'm going to shake the earth, like at Mount Sinai. And our God is a consuming fire. He comes as fire. But it's not a literal fire of the kind that blackened the peak of Mount Sinai in Arabia, which we have pictures of course. And people can see that the picture of the blackened peak, Jabal al-Lawz over there in Saudi Arabia, northwest part of Saudi Arabia. There is a consuming fire that is coming that has a whole different purpose. Well, it's really not a different purpose. The fire of God has always been for the same purpose. But it is a spiritual fire this time. It is a fire that is internal. It is being internalized. Remember, the fire deals with the presence of God. It is, you know, God is the consuming fire. In Moses' day, it was external up there on the mount. At Pentecost, it was the tongues of fire upon the individual heads. But in tabernacles, the fire is totally internalized, and it's within us. And there it is consuming fire as well, to consume anything within that is not of God. Anything which can be shaken will be shaken. Anything which can be consumed will be consumed. All flesh must be consumed in order that the Spirit may have full reign. And when we're nothing but ashes, then we're back to nothing again. And all we have remaining within us is the Spirit of God. No resistance. Nothing left to burn. That's the Feast of Tabernacles. That's the time of perfection. That's the time when all the things that can be shaken will have been shaken. So, yet once more, it indicates one more time other than in the days of Moses when he shook the earth. When that point comes, then we will see the greatest work that God has ever done on the face of the earth. That will not be the time when everything is done. That's the time of just beginning. Then we'll be able to fulfill the great commission that we were unable to do with only a Pentecostal fulfillment. Pentecost was only a beginning point. And unfortunately, under Pentecost, it takes off real fast, but then it fades. And every generation has experienced this. They get revival, and the next generation fades. Then they get revival again, and then it fades. And it's always because of the same patterns of Pentecost. Pentecost was when they offered up two loaves of bread baked with leaven. And the leaven is what kills us. Unless that leaven is burned in the fire, it will continue to have working within us. That leaven is always sin. Pentecost was the only feast where they actually had leaven in the offering to God. The only one that was allowed, in fact, it was mandated. That was to show us we could not be perfected under Pentecost. Or the only way to be perfected under Pentecost, given the fact that leaven is in it, is to have those two loaves baked with leaven. It's the baking process. It's the fire. It's the fire of God that consumes the leaven within us, because our God is a consuming fire. So like Moses, we are called up into the mount, go up in the oven where we belong. Otherwise, we're half-baked, if at all. Right? It's the only way under Pentecost that we can find perfection, given the fact that we are leavened, is to submit to the fire of God, His disciplines. It's the only way that it's possible. And when God then consumes us from the inside, rather than what are trying to be baked from the outside by our own self-discipline, when God works us within us, He writes His law in our hearts, and ultimately the way He leads us consumes all the flesh until we're nothing but ashes and we're down to nothing, and then He is everything. The cross looked like, the day of the cross, that Passover, looked like the total failure. It was the darkest day in history, kind of in more than one way. God turned the lights out for 3 hours at noon. It's very interesting that that was a day of victory, but it did not look like it. Oh, did it ever look like the end of the world? God does things so that it doesn't, the things which are not what appear to be. That way you have to see it with the eye of faith. You have to know, because you have to know that you have heard His word. And that's when you have only what you heard, what you see is nothing. Again, the fall of 96 was a seed for the future. It was a seed for something else, or for that was going to grow up. Now, of course, if you deal with the law of fruit-bearing trees in Leviticus 19, I believe it is, when you plant a tree, if you consider that day to be seed planting time, you cannot eat of the tree, of the fruit of the tree, for 3 years. In the fourth year, the fruit from the tree in the fourth year is the first fruits unto God. You still don't eat of it, but you give it to God. In the fifth year, you can eat the fruits thereof. Now that's the law. That takes us to the year, what? 2000 to 2001. See, from 95 to 96, or 96 to 97 is the first year, to 1798, to 99, to the year 2000. The fifth year, or really from 1999, from the fall of 1999 to the fall of 2000, is the fourth year, is where the fruit of the trees are dedicated to God. Now, is it not interesting that October of 1999 happens to be Jesus' 2000th birthday? Hosea 6 prophecy, after 2 days He will raise us up. In the third day we shall live in His sight. The third day, technically, by this way of reckoning, you know, a day being 1,000 years, by this reckoning, the third day actually begins in late September of the year 1999. This is a time to watch. You know, next year in September, October is definitely a time to watch, because this, again, by certain time periods, this is a cutoff point. And I believe that things cannot actually manifest until then. But this also, this 1999 in the fall, also has to do with the beginning, with the fourth year, the beginning of the fourth year of the law of fruit-bearing trees. Because very definitely, this seed, this Zerubbabel, the seed of Babylon, okay, that is, we're born in Babylon, but we're coming out. But this seed, this Zera, if you were, or the Zion, the seed for the future, is actually planted here at the Feast of Tabernacles in 96. And that seed, I believe, is going to bear fruit. The fruit, however, is considered uncircumcised or unclean for 3 years. And in the fourth year, it's offered to God. In the fifth year, from the year 2000 to 2001, is when you start eating the fruits of your labors. And that's when it first comes in. Now, I have seen this law of fruit-bearing trees a number of times in ministries, including my own. When God does things, He starts with a tiny seed. It starts with little, you know, the seed of a mustard seed, if you will. Starts out with practically nothing. Nobody would ever see that this becomes a great tree later. And even that little seed has to die. Situation hopeless, but not impossible. But God said He's going to fill this house with glory. That's what I'm looking for. That's a word that I hear. I take God's word at face value here, because this isn't a matter of just reading the Bible. It's a matter of hearing the word. And I know that that word is applicable in my life and in your life. And in general, we are in the time period where God is going to do this. We're going to see this actually come to pass, the fulfillment of the Feast of Tabernacles, whereas it's been declared, and the word won't come back void, but that's also a seed being planted. It's a seed for the future. It's also the seed of the law, the yod. It's the law that's being planted. How do we know that that's tabernacles as well? Because the Feast of Tabernacles was the only feast day where they read through the whole law. You find that in Nehemiah chapter 8, the pattern. Tabernacles is the feast day where His law is fully written on your heart. The work of Pentecost, of writing the law on your heart, has been completed. And now we have His nature. We have gone from Jacob, or Yaakov, to Israel. And the only thing that carries over is the Yod. That's why it's important to understand books of the law. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Genesis 2. All of these things have the basis of Bible prophecy. If we start in the New Testament with prophecy, we're going to fall all over ourselves because we don't have the background, whereas all the feast days are the basis of all prophecy. Passover, prophesied of Christ's coming. Pentecost, prophesied of the outpouring of the Spirit in Acts. Tabernacles, prophesies of the second work of Christ. We have to understand these in order to get some idea of what's going on. Back to the foundations. And the glory of this latter house shall be greater than the former, and in this place I will give peace. Haggai 2:10. This starts kind of another little section here. In the 24th day of the ninth month, okay, 24th day of the ninth month, that's basically December. What happened then? What does he say happens? 9:24, foundation of the temple was laid, of Zerubbabel's temple. The foundation was actually laid about, well, in 533 B.C., which is about, 13 years before Haggai began his prophecy. The foundation was one of the first things that was laid. You'll find that back in Ezra. But this is the anniversary of the laying of the foundation of the temple in the second year of Darius. So it's in 520. Okay? The foundation of the temple was not laid in 520. The foundation was laid in 533 B.C., 13 years earlier. But this is the anniversary. And so in a sense, it's like the same date. Because they had laid the foundation on this date, it was like a seed being planted in the earth. It was a beginning point. It was a beginning point by faith. He says, in the 24th day of the ninth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, ask now the priests concerning the law, saying, get the priest's opinion on the law here. See if they know the law. If one bear holy flesh in the skirt of his garment, or with his skirt, do touch bread or pottage or wine or oil or any meat, shall it be holy? And the priest answered and said, no. Then said Haggai, if one that is unclean by a dead body touch any of these, shall it be unclean? And the priest answered and said, it shall be unclean. A very simple legal question here. But what's the point? Then answered Haggai and said, so is this people, and so is this nation before me, saith the Lord. And so is every work of their hands, and that which they offer there is unclean. Boy, what a switch. First of all, he says, hey, you're doing great. God is with you and building this temple, and I'm going to glorify this, and this is going to be so great. And now he does a switcheroo and says, hey, everything you've done is unclean. What? Come on. What is going on here? I mean, the people should have been totally confused by that time, just like us. Well, why is that? Well, if you're bearing this sacrifice your carrying it, your shirt tail, or your the hem of your garment or whatever, touches anything else to eat, you know, bread, pottage, wine, oil, or any meat, shall it be holy? Shall what be holy? Verse 13, if one that is unclean by a dead body touch any of these, shall it be unclean? The priest says, yeah, it'll be unclean. What do you mean, unclean by a dead body? In other words, if you touched a dead body, read Numbers chapter 9 on this, you had to be unclean for 7 days. And you had to go through these particular rituals, you know, being cleansed on the third day, and then on the seventh day, and then finally on the eighth day you could resume things. So, for instance, when Joseph and Nicodemus carried Jesus' body off of the cross on the preparation day for Passover, they would have been ineligible to keep Passover that night. They would have been touching a dead body. Right? So they would have had to keep the second Passover, which was a month later. Remember this whole controversy came up in Numbers chapter 9? There were two Passovers. If you couldn't keep the one, you were to keep the other one on the 15th of the second month. So the question here is that, if you've touched a dead body, or if anyone that's unclean by dead body, even if he's a priest, if he touches any of these things, he would render them unclean as well. Now the fact is, we are all mortal. We have death in us. Everything we touch is unclean. The Feast of Tabernacles deals with this question of coming into immortality, the glorification of the body. Okay? So until that point, everything we touch is unclean. Here we are building this temple that's supposedly holy unto God. God has to raise up a priesthood, though, who can offer up sacrifices that are acceptable to God. And the fact is, the fact that we are mortal means that we cannot really offer up anything to God that is acceptable because we have death all over us. Jesus is the only one who could do it. That's why he is the high priest and he is the one who has entered in. But what about the rest of us who are aspiring to the priesthood? Let's look at Malachi 3:3. Just a few pages over. And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver, and he shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. Unless God purifies the sons of Levi, they cannot offer an offering in righteousness. You see? But he has to purify them as silver. He has to refine them. Back in Haggai, he says, the silver is mine and the gold is mine. He's talking about people. He's refining us as silver and gold. And that is done by a heat process. He lights the fire, and he is a consuming fire. By the time he gets through with us, the priesthood is to be cleansed. And the cleansing is not complete until we are brought fully into immortality. When we are no longer have death within us. When the bodies that we have, or are raised from the dead with, whichever, are totally manifesting the glory of God. That is the only way that God can raise up a priesthood that is acceptable and can offer up the right kind of sacrifices for the time that we are coming into in this tabernacle's age. It's the only way. Therefore, we have to see these feast days fulfilled. We must see the Feast of Trumpets, which is the resurrection of the dead. We must see the Day of Atonement, which is the Jubilee, and we must see the Feast of Tabernacles, which culminates with the glory that comes upon us of those who are alive and remain. That, I believe, is what is going to be fulfilled at some time, and which has already been declared, and it is going to be fulfilled, I think. The declaration is the beginning of a countdown, if you will. It's a countdown. Okay, back to verse 15. We're starting to get toward the end of this chapter. And now I pray you consider from this day and forward, or this day and upward, from before a stone was laid upon a stone in the temple of the Lord. Remember back in those days, he's telling you, since those days were when one came to a heap of 20 measures, there were but 10, and one came to the press fat for to draw out 50 vessels out of the press, there were but 20. I smote you with blasting and with mildew and with hail in all the labors of your hands, yet you turn not to me, saith the Lord. He's referring back to the first chapter, which of course we dealt with in, I believe, in our second tape on this, where he says in verse 6, you have sown much but bring in little. And these are the evidences by which we know that these things have not yet come to pass, or that this temple is not yet completed, is because we basically are finding ourselves under the curses of the law in Deuteronomy 28 and in Leviticus 26, where he says, you know, you'll sow much and reap little. These are all the because of the violation of the law. And so we had the same evidence in Haggai's day when his temple was not being built, but everybody was down to the decorations of their own house. He says, hey, the time is yet, because you are liable, because why? Because you find yourself under the judgments of the law. You come and expect 50 and you get 20. Well, you know, we too have been rather unproductive. And I speak from personal experience too. We've been unproductive. We have not brought forth truly that which God has intended. We've not seen the blessings that we should be having. Now I know it's because maybe the time is not yet. But Haggai's prophecy is now here is the time. So we should see a turnaround when God completes that which he is doing in us. Verse 18, consider now from this day and upward, from the 24th day of the 9th month, even from the day that the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider it. Is the seed yet in the barn? Yea, as yet the vine, the fig tree, and the pomegranate, and the olive tree hath not brought forth. From this day will I bless you. So he's telling them ahead of time that because they have laid the foundation already, that's like planting the seed in the ground, laying the foundation of the temple. It's like planting a tree. And he says, because of that act of faith, from this day forward, I'll begin to bless you. So you see, it's a process of time. But from this day forth, I will bless you. And again, the word of the Lord came unto Haggai in the 24th day of the month, saying, speak unto Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth, and I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms, and I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen, or the nations. And I will overthrow the chariots and those that ride in them, and the horses and the riders shall come down, every one by the sword of his brother. Sound a little bit like Pharaoh's army? The horse and rider thrown into the sea? Yeah, it's very much like that. There's the shaking of the heavens and the earth, so that the kingdoms of this world will collapse, so that only those things which can stand will remain. And that is the kingdom of God, the stone kingdom. In that day, saith the Lord of hosts, I will take thee, O Zerubbabel, my servant, son of Shealtiel, saith the Lord, and will make thee as a signet, or some kind of a ring, okay, an authoritative ring. For I have chosen thee, saith the Lord of hosts. This man is, his name being the seed or the born in Babylon, and he has come out of Babylon to rebuild this temple and do this work of faith. He really is the embodiment or the representative of the remnant of overcomers, or the overcoming remnant who returned. Isaiah 7:3 and Isaiah 10:21. It is this overcoming remnant working with the high priest Joshua, or Yeshua, who is Jesus, right? It's this overcoming remnant that is given the ring of authority to rule. See? Rule and to teach, yes. So you've got these two entities here. You've got the priest and you've got the governor. And the high priest and the governor. And Joshua the high priest is basically a representative of Jesus himself, and you'll see this in Zechariah 3, if you look at that, third chapter of Zechariah, especially in verse 8. Hear now, O Joshua the high priest, thou and thy fellows that sit before thee, for they are men wondered at. For behold, I will bring forth my servant, the branch. For behold, the stone that I have laid before Joshua. Upon one stone shall be seven eyes, and behold, I will engrave the graving thereof, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. In that day, saith the Lord of hosts, you shall call every man his neighbor under the vine and under the fig tree. See, it deals with my servant, the branch. That's one of the titles of Jesus himself. And he removes the iniquity in one day. This is all part of the shaking. I believe that it is time, almost time here, where God is beginning to shake the kingdoms. And when he says in verse 22 of Haggai 2, I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms. If you recall, we saw the first really major sign of this shortly after our declaration in 96. The declaration came, of course, as we said, on October 5, 1996. And then on November 14 of 1996, the coronation stone under the throne, under the British throne, Westminster Abbey, was moved and taken to Scotland, returned to Scotland after 700 years, and it arrived there on November 30, St. Andrew's Day of 1996. That's when the coronation stone arrives at Edinburgh. Now, we've dealt with that before, but that was a major sign of what God is doing in shaking all nations and overthrowing the kingdoms. The coronation stone signifies the divine right to rule. Jacob's pillar, the anointed stone, anointed being Christ, that rock that followed them, that rock was Christ. So many things about that. This left, of course, November 14, which was Prince Charles' 48th birthday. So he lost the divine right to rule on his birthday. He was taken to Scotland, and on November 30, placed on the oak table at the castle there at Edinburgh, Scotland. And at that time, Prince Andrew, who presided on St. Andrew's Day, to the people of Scotland, whose patron saint is St. Andrew's, St. Andrew. Andrew means manly. So does Charles, by the way, in a different language. So they are both of men, and this is the princes of men, or the kingdoms of men, losing the divine right to rule and being given to the St. Andrews, or the saints of the Most High. Basically, we're dealing with the patterns of Daniel chapter 7 being fulfilled here. These are the signs of what's going on. And of course, immediately when they announced that move in July of 96, just before all this moved, when they announced that that the stone was going to be moved, but they didn't say where, we find that in Edinburgh, we've got the cloning of the sheep, Dolly. Right? Interesting sign. And Dolly has now given birth to a little lamb in April. The cloning of the sheep, you see. You have the big lamb, who is Christ, and you have the little lambs, us. And we are in his image, you know, a clone, if you will. There's so many interesting ways of looking at it, and you can see prophecy being fulfilled right in the newspapers if you know how to see how the signs are happening all around us. There are many, many signs of the times if we just learn the language of what God is saying in these things. So, he's overthrowing the kingdoms, shaking the heavens and the earth. And when he does, and as he does, he is making Zerubbabel, he's giving him the signet ring
The signet ring going to him is really the transfer of authority from the kingdoms of this world to the kingdom of God. I guess we'll stop there.
One further note here. The question is asked about the signet ring again and the signature. The signet ring was something that was like a signature where you sign documents. The official seal, if you will, is what it was. And it was legally binding then. And we find this concept to be perpetuated in the New Testament in the concept of the huiothesia, that is the adoption of sons. And the huiothesia, usually translated the adoption of sons, it literally means huio or huios is sons. Thesia is this adoption or placement of sons. It's the ceremony whereby when a son comes into full maturity and he becomes a chip off the old block, where the father can trust the son to do everything that he would do normally, he then empowers his son with this adoption ceremony. It's like coming of age or power of attorney, sort of, where the son is given, like perhaps a signet ring, and he can then sign his name or put his seal, or he can put the seal upon whatever documents, and it's binding upon the father's estate. Being a signet ring is really an Old Testament way of saying of the New Testament concept, which is the adoption of sons, coming into full maturity of sonship. The whole idea of sonship and the manifestation of the sons of God. The word of the son becomes as binding as the father because the son only does and says what he hears his father say and do. Therefore, so everything the son does is what the father was doing anyway. Just like what Jesus is. He's the perfect example. It didn't have a specific age attached to it. But when we're also dealing here with the priesthood. In the priesthood, under Moses, the age was 30 years. But under David, it came to be 20 years in the last words of David. We dealt with this last in our last tape. The last words of David was that the priesthood comes into its own at the age of 20, not at 30. This is we tied this in also because you know that they retired at the age of 50. Basically, when they were one jubilee old, they retired. We related this to this time period from 1986 to 2036. 1986 being the 120th jubilee from Adam, declared in 96 but retroactive to 86, this is when this priesthood was actually born. We are now in the 12th year, and we must be about our Father's business. And in the year 2006, we will be 20 years old. That's the year that is 2,520 years earlier was the completion of the temple. So in Haggai's day, he prophesied about a temple in 515 BC, but if you add 2,520 years to it, the temple is completed in 2006, and there is where you need priests to minister. And it just happens that that is 20 years from this time of the birthing of the priesthood, I believe. This had stymied me for a while because I was thinking 30 years, and I thought, we got 10 years of an interim here. There's a gap. You're going to have 10 years without, you have a temple without a priesthood? What's going on? And then the Lord showed me, and I read it, of course, in there, straightened me out on that, and I realized, oh, well, of course, David had changed this to 20 years by revelation. So it fit perfectly again this year, 2006. So it was originally 30 years, but now it's 20. Okay, I think we better quit here.